This is Dr. David Black, founding director of the American Mindfulness Research Association and associate professor of preventive medicine at the University of Southern California. My guest today is Dr. Seth Siegel, clinical psychologist, Zen Buddhist priest, associate chaplain at White Plains Hospital in New York. He was a faculty member of Yale University School of Medicine for 27 years and now retired from that position. His recent book, published in 2020, is called Buddhism and Human Flourishing, a Modern Western Perspective. I've had the great pleasure of working closely with Seth for almost a decade now. Seth writes the Science Highlights column for Mindfulness Research Monthly, for which I serve as in the role of founding editor-in-chief. And Seth, in that role, critically examines the top work in the field and does us the great favor of translating that work for the general public. Welcome, Seth.
Hi, good morning, David.
Good morning. So you have this rich and varied background that I just mentioned, so many hats and so many perspectives, and culturally have seen so many shifts in the use of different wellness practices, in particular, mindfulness-based interventions. I see a convergence in your work, and tell me if this is correct, something about human healing in clinical settings. You seem to be helping a lot of people in different ways. Can you talk about these roles? People may not know exactly what some of these titles mean, and how have they converged to some point called mindfulness and mindfulness-based programs?
Well, that's a complex kind of question, David. I in a way, I don't think of healing as what I'm involved in as much as it is a kind of a creating opportunities for wholeness and for well-being. And I really think in an Aristotelian sense about the idea of eudaimonia, or high levels of well-being that human beings are capable of achieving through growth and through development and through awareness. So I see all of my roles converging in that sort of way. When you're doing psychotherapy, or whether you're doing chaplaincy work, or whether you're doing teaching of mindfulness, the aim is always to kind of get people to be more in touch with themselves, to be more aware of the whole fullness of their being, to be more aware of the present moment, and to find ways to move forward out of predicaments that they're in, to find new and creative ways of moving forward and growing.
Great. And so can you inform me about your role, Zen Buddhist priest, associate chaplain? What do these roles entail? What is the history and context of you becoming those things? And then what do those roles entail?
Okay, they all came as a surprise to me, I suppose. I mean, I never thought about those kinds of roles to begin with. I never even thought of being a psychologist when I first entered college. I was going to be a biochemist initially. But somehow you find your way into these things. There are interests that kind of light the way for you and draw you towards them. So initially I became interested in psychology because I wanted to find some way to really be useful to other people. And I found that biochemistry was not the best way for me to do that, that I wasn't somebody who could sit at a lab bench all day long, and I didn't like doing a lot of math. And on the other hand, I really liked sitting down with people and listening to their stories and hearing what they were going through and what they thought about things. So I had a period in my life around age 18 when I saw a therapist myself and found him enormously helpful for my own development. So that naturally drew me to the field as a sophomore in college. And I never thought of becoming a priest at all. I was not a particularly religious person. But as I got more and more involved in mindfulness and in Buddhism in parallel with mindfulness, I was drawn to both of them around the same time. I found that was one way to advance my own study, was to kind of fall under the tutelage of a preceptor who was going to direct my studies in Buddhism. And I also thought that the way Buddhism was evolving in the United States and in the West, there wasn't a space really for people to undergo life rituals or rites of passage within the Buddhist framework. I mean, if you weren't born within the Buddhist community and hadn't grown up in one, what if you wanted to have a Buddhist marriage or a Buddhist funeral or a Buddhist uh, uh, blessing for the birth of a baby or something of that sort. There wasn't any way for people to access rituals of that sort. So I was interested in playing that role in the community. And also after I had retired from psychology, and as I was pursuing this more, I saw there was an opportunity to use the skills I had previously had as a clinical psychologist in hospital settings as a chaplain, you know, to go around on a medical surgical floor and talk to people about the dilemmas they were in, what choices they were facing in their life, and to do it from the perspective of not so much healing people in a kind of a fixing people who are broken, so to speak, but in a way of just illuminating, helping them illuminate their path forward, helping them gain some clarity. And I'm trying to find the right word here, and it's eluding me for a moment. Basically helping them kind of sort through their own values and see what was important to them and maybe kind of help them kind of come to see a clearer direction for themselves moving forward towards better health. So to me, that was an amazing process, being in the hospital, meeting people cold. You know, maybe I'd see 20 people a day. You saw for 5 minutes, some you saw for 2 hours. You would never see them again, probably, unless they were very sick and in the hospital for weeks on end. And yet you found you could make an impact in people's lives, and people would remember you months and years later and come back and say that intervention made a tremendous difference for me, you know? So being a priest gave me kind of entree into the hospital, because you know, you couldn't just walk in as a stranger and do pastoral care. But if you were already ordained, you could come in and do that. So it really, things just dovetailed very nicely for me.
Very good. Your clinical work that began in 1980, we had talked a little bit before. You said your recognition of mindfulness-based programs started in the 1990s, and that was really interesting to see your perspective there and how you gained access to the program and how you started teaching the program. Do you want to talk about what happened in the 1990s that was more formal around mindfulness-based programs?
Sure. Well, you know, at that time I had a clinical psychology private practice, and I was seeing a lot of chronic pain patients, and I had been honing whatever skills I could develop in that area, biofeedback, hypnosis, things of that sort, imagery, was not terribly satisfied with the way I was reaching many patients. I mean, some people were helped by it, but many were not. And around that time, I was watching a PBS television program called The Healing of the Mind that Bill Moyers had on PBS. It was a series that he had. And in that series, he focused one episode on Jon Kabat-Zinn at the Stress Reduction Clinic in Worcester, Massachusetts. And you got to see films of him working with chronic pain patients using meditation. And I was just absolutely enchanted when I saw that, both because he was such a compelling figure and the work he was doing was so really, really touching. And also because it evoked memories within me of the previous experiences I had had as an adolescent and as a young adult, when I had an interest in Buddhism after Alan Watts had visited our college and given a series of lectures on it. And I had become quite enthused and read a lot about it, but didn't really have a way to follow that path up. There weren't any teachers nearby, and there wasn't any local community nearby that I could belong to and practice with. So it was an interest that had maybe lay fallow for about a couple of decades there. But seeing John doing this work with patients just rekindled that, and I understood how it could be useful immediately. And a short time afterwards, one of John's teachers, Ferris Urbanowski, came down to Connecticut to do a one-day workshop, and I did the workshop with her. And I can only describe that workshop as really life-changing in many ways. I mean, I took to the practice immediately. I immediately saw its potential, not for my patients, but for me. I thought it was for my patients initially, but I saw how meaningful it was for me. And I said, this is something I want to do every day for the rest of my life, you know, which is quite a commitment to make after a one-day workshop. And I went up to Ferris and I said, Ferris, how can I learn more about this? Can I do an internship with John over at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center? And she said, well, yes, you can, but first you have to have your own established meditation practice, you know, at least a year of doing it daily. And you have to have gone on at least one 10-day silent Buddhist retreat, meditation retreat. And after you've done that, you can apply. So that's what I started doing. I sat sitting by myself in my own inept way daily, you know, for a minimum of 20 minutes a day. And after I'd done that for a year, I went ahead to the Insight Meditation Center in Barre, Massachusetts, and did a 10-day retreat with the late Ruth Denison, which was a marvelous experience. And then I went ahead and applied and did an internship, a six-month internship, over at the UMass Medical Center, which involved, it's not as intense as it sounds, it involved traveling up to Worcester one day a week. And we went ahead and participated in one of the clinics there for the chronic pain patients. And then we also met individually with Ferris and with John and with the other teachers and had various didactic kinds of things going on. And again, that was a tremendous emotional experience for me. I mean, I've been doing group therapy for many, many years. And, you know, I've read Irv Yalom and everything he had to say about group transference and so forth. But I never experienced it that fully until I was in that particular trainee group over at the hospital. We were really quite a cohort that were very emotionally connected to each other. And I found that not only was I learning how to do a technique, but I was learning a kind of a new relationship to life. And I actually felt myself changing in the process too. I felt, for example, I was much more in tune with my emotions. I felt like my heart had actually widened, you know, so that I was more emotionally connected to other people in ways that I hadn't before. It was really a transformative experience. And after that, that was really my springboard into more deep Buddhist practice as well. Because I went on quite a number of retreats after that at the Insight Meditation Society and at the Center for Meditative Inquiry and a number of other places. So I would do at least maybe about 20 days of retreat a year for quite a number of years. And I also began practicing. I started a mindfulness-based stress reduction group at the hospital where I was director of psychology. And we work with chronic pain patients. I also ran a group for the medical staff so that the medical director and the head of the Yale internship for primary care medicine and a number of other physicians, endocrinologists and so forth, came weekly with me. And we did a full 8-week MBSR program for them just to introduce them to the practice. I gave a number of grand rounds, you know, at our local hospital and down at Yale and elsewhere. I began doing workshops over at the consultation center of the Yale School of Medicine. We do 8-hour workshops to introduce people to the practice. And that was really my entrance into this, say in the late 1990s and early 2000s.
So one of the reasons I really love talking to you about this today is because you've seen the evolution of what had happened perhaps in the 1950s and 60s culturally that set a tone for an acceptance of Eastern philosophies and perspectives about human consciousness and how we can perhaps train parts of that for a better life. I'm going to be careful to say the word healing, but a value system that can perhaps bring people to their better life. And then seeing the evolution, and my attention is mostly to the research world. So the 1980s and the publications coming out of the pain clinic at University of Massachusetts. So the technical viewpoint on do the programs work. And then into the 90s when it appears that, you know, training programs and a more clinical acceptance was occurring of MBSR and related practices. And then where we've come 20 years, 30 years later, right? And we just kind of see a mindfulness-based intervention pretty much readily available everywhere. So from your perspective, this is really interesting to me. How did you see mindfulness-based interventions, perhaps MBSR specifically, starting in the 90s, maybe because that was your direct experience? And then where it is today? Because I think this can get us into the deeper discussion about what it means to meditate and what mindfulness means in the West. What have you seen happen, maybe clinically, maybe culturally, in the use of mindfulness to where from the 1990s to where we are now?
Well, I mean, one thing is we've seen an explosion of different uses for it in clinical psychology. So we have this whole alphabet soup of different interventions now that are mindfulness-based in one way. They're starting with MBSR, and then next to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And of course, Marsha Linehan, through a different route, integrates that into a dialectical behavioral therapy. And yet from a totally separate direction, we find similar growth with Steve Haynes's ACT therapy. So we see all that. And then we see very specific interest. We see mindfulness-based eating therapies, mindfulness-based attention, prevention, attention degrading in the troops. We see specialty treatments for cancer and for, I'm thinking of fibromyalgia, for you name it, there is an intervention for it now that's mindfulness-based. So we've seen that explosion in one field, as we've seen the kind of a third wave, let's say, of behavioral therapies come about that have integrated mindfulness into them. But we've also seen the explosion of mindfulness uses elsewhere in school systems, on sports teams. I know in my locale, local churches and synagogues have mindfulness sitting groups that they've integrated in with their particular religious approaches. You see Headspace and other kinds of apps that people can buy that don't involve group interventions or individual interventions, but just involve you and some kind of digital interface. And then you see mindfulness coloring books and mindfulness-based essential oils. And it's become a billion-dollar industry in terms of all kinds of products that you can buy that have mindfulness attached to it in some ways straightforward, in some ways rather dubious. So you certainly see it in headlines. Time magazine will feature it, for example, as, you know, mindfulness, the new revolution, and so on. So there's been an explosion of it into the culture, and it's used in all different kinds of formats. And sometimes teachers are very well trained. Sometimes they only have minimal training. And the way that it's sold can vary depending on the venue where it's being employed. So that at times it can be sold as a religious type of thing. Well, this is Buddhist meditation. At times it can be sold as a humanistic psychology intervention, something that puts you in alignment with your values. At times it can be sold as a health intervention, something that facilitates your own caring for your own health. At times it can be sold as a neuropsychological kind of intervention, help rewire your brain. You know, it gets sold to the public in all different kinds of ways and under all different kinds of guises. And of course, once this has happened, there's no way of regulating the practice anymore. So that I know, you know, very early on, you know, John, for example, tried to establish some formal training that would make people able to say that they were MBSR teachers. But it's just as it is in psychotherapy right now. To be a psychologist, you have to have certain credentials, but anyone can say they're a psychotherapist and hang a shingle on their door and they don't have to have any training at all. So there's that kind of worry as well. The other thing that's become more aware of as time goes on is that this may not be an appropriate intervention for everybody. So that I think of some of the research that's been done that shows that there are casualties in mindfulness meditation programs, whether they're and casualties in Buddhist meditation programs as well. And we don't know yet how severe these are, to what extent they are, who's more liable to be vulnerable to them, or even how to fix the problems once they occur. So this is a whole new area of research as well, just trying to become aware that this might not be for everybody.
Just to emphasize what you just said, meaning that there are adverse events for some individuals participating, whether it be worsened report of symptoms, say mental health symptoms. Is that what, I'm just trying to clarify what you meant by.
There's a whole, I mean, the range of problems in meditation casualties is just enormous. I mean, there can be cognitive problems, perceptual problems, motor problems, affective problems, problems with identity. I mean, and these can occur not only in people with past histories of psychosis or people who are fragile or people with trauma, for example, histories, but it can occur in people who have been mentally healthy up to a time and are even teachers themselves now of mindfulness. And they can be quite extreme what they can experience. They can really feel like a total shattering of their ability to function in the world that can last for years. So, and it doesn't seem to be tied to, the more intense the practice is, I suppose there's a greater risk. There's a greater risk, for example, from intensely practicing on retreats, for example, or lengthy retreats than there is just doing a half hour a day. But even people who just do, say, 20 minutes a day can still have, you know, problems resulting from it. I'm not saying this is a common problem, but we know it exists. And we don't know quite how to identify people who are prone to it. Let me tell you a story that just happened the other week with me. I was a teacher on a Zen retreat. And a fellow person who was on the retreat who I did not know well at all came up to me to meet individually with me during what's called Daisan, which is a one-on-one meeting in a Zen retreat with a teacher. And he began to tell me about his meditation practice, which was quite intensive. He meditated several hours a day, every day. But what he told me about his practice was that every moment he did it, it felt horrible to him. Okay. But he felt he ought to do it because it was going to fix whatever was wrong with him. So he was trying harder and harder. But what would happen is he would sit there to meditate. And then he said, I would feel that if I breathe too much, I would be overwhelmed and I would fall apart. So I tried to restrict my breathing and control my breathing so it wouldn't happen. But that the more I tried to do this, the more I had to lessen my breath more and more, or else I would be flooded with this energy. And I'm listening to him say this, and I'm thinking to myself, this is the wrong person to be on a retreat. This is a person who is hanging on to his sanity by his fingernails. He's at the edge of a precipice that he's about to fall over. I don't know what his story is or why he's there, but meditating is not what he should be doing. And so I talked to him and to his own meditation teacher in his meditation group to say that maybe he should only be doing about 5 minutes a day, if any. And maybe he really ought to be seeing a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist rather than doing this as his treatment.
Good point. Yeah, and restricting the dose could be the cure there. And so we have a similar situation. We produce a program by a lead teacher at a university for students, and we always stay on guard and help the teacher recognize the importance that some students may actually need psychotherapy versus just entering a meditation course. And they do often recognize that when the students are reporting severe cases, and the teacher suggests that, you know, us informally exploring these issues without guided help is not the best decision right now. And we will make proper referrals. So you definitely see that those cases are very important.
And sometimes people turn to meditation looking for things that it can't do for them. And I remember a talk I heard a couple of decades ago by George Bowman, who is a Zen teacher in a Korean Zen tradition, Quantum Zen. And he talked about how the fact that he had been meditating for 20 years and it had never helped him feel any better in terms of his depression. And 2 weeks on Prozac took care of that. So we don't want people to look to meditation as if it's a cure-all for everything, because it's not. I mean, it can be helpful for people who are depressed, but it's not really a treatment for a disease.
That's a very good point. Should we make a counterpoint to that, and giving your background in clinical work, could we say, given that human cognition is a very strong computational tool and consciousness is a very strange phenomena that humans have to experience, could it be the case that any way in which we apply new computations, say through cognitive behavioral therapy, through acceptance and commitment therapy, any type of therapy given to the person for which it does not match well, could suffer problems as an outcome if they do too much of it? Like if you're paying too much attention to your thought process and trying to change the content of the material of thoughts, for example, could this be, no matter what practice we use to try to better ourselves, could there always be a negative outcome for some people?
Absolutely. I don't think about it in computational terms like that, but I think every therapy has the potential to make people worse. If it wasn't powerful, it wouldn't be any good at all. And power. And certainly another field I was in years ago was working with.
Sorry, Seth, can you say that last part again? We lost you. So the power what?
What I was saying was that if therapy is going to have some power, it means it's power for better or worse. There's nothing that can make you better and can't make you worse. I mean, water is wonderful, but if you drink too much of it, it'll kill you. You know, I'm just reminded that one field I was in earlier was I was working with patients with dissociative disorders. And for a number of years, I was president of the New England Society for the Study of Dissociation and Trauma. And I was acutely aware of how many therapists were making patients with dissociative disorders worse by the kind of therapy they're doing instead of better. So, and got to write a book chapter on that. But I think any therapy has that potential to be harmful to people at the wrong time and under the wrong circumstances and in the wrong relationship.
So your recent book, Buddhism and Human Flourishing, Modern Western Perspective, this continues the theme of the convergence between Eastern philosophy, modern Western uses. You were giving many examples in many domains of professions and in styles of format, such as app-based programs. So maybe we'll turn to that, to your book at this point. Do you highlight some fundamental differences between what Buddhism had originally either had the purpose for creating these practices for, or the ethical content of a practice such as mindfulness training? And how has that differed? And I know this is a big question, so you maybe pick out a couple things that you would like to talk about to how it is being used currently. Maybe there is not a full understanding, or it's fine the way it is for the current time.
Well, I first want to just state that there isn't any one thing called Buddhism, that Buddhism is this 2,500-year-old tradition with many voices dialoguing within it and has been under constant transformation and change ever since it began. It's never held still. So that if you're asking what is Buddhism, you'd have to ask what year and in what country and so forth. And it's not terribly different than asking, well, what is Christianity? And then trying to figure out what Unitarians and fundamentalists and Christian scientists and Jehovah Witnesses and Mormons all have in common, right? There are themes in common, yes, and then enormous differences along the way. The book, Buddhism and Human Flourishing, is really about how do we modern Westerners, those of us who consider ourselves modern Westerners, who are inheritors of the Western tradition, which includes the Greco-Roman tradition and the Judeo-Christian tradition and the Western Enlightenment tradition, and then all of postmodernism and everything that's come since then, right? We think about us moderns, and we encounter something like Buddhism that we find enticing or intriguing. We find things we like about it very much. We get involved in the practice, and we quickly find that there are problems that arise for us as moderns. There are things we can't quite believe ourselves in our bones, given our own interest in empiricism, and given our own interest in rationalism and naturalism and everything else that we Westerners believe in. So for example, just to take a more trivial case, it's very hard for Westerners to believe in reincarnation. It just doesn't come naturally for us to believe in it. We believe we die and that's it, consciousness winks out and it's done, or we're Judeo-Christians and we believe to go to a heaven or a hell, but we don't believe in rebirth. So it's a non-starter for us. And yet rebirth is the cornerstone for the entire Buddhist philosophy. If you take it away, everything falls apart. Ethics is based on the idea of rebirth. The idea of liberation is the idea of ending rebirth, and so on. So obviously something has to change if it's going to be suitable for most Westerners, most modern Westerners, to make use of it in some kind of way. And there are other differences as well. And I think the one that's most important for me is the idea of what is an ideal human life really like. Okay. The Buddhists traditionally have a particular view about that Buddhism, which is that we let go of desire and aversion and attachment. Okay. And we become super calm, and we don't get angry anymore, and we don't get greedy anymore, and so on. So there are two issues with that. One is, can we as modern Westerners and as psychologists really believe there is such a state for human beings where they don't desire things anymore, or they're not greedy for things anymore, or they don't have sexual urges anymore, or whatever it is that is gone? Like, it's like an extrication of the limbic system, right? Do we believe that's really possible? And the answer is, we don't think it is, right? I mean, the brain is plastic, but not that plastic. We think that we can do a lot of top-down suppression of what's going on in the limbic system, but we can't extirpate it. And maybe mindfulness does shrink the amygdala a little bit, but it doesn't remove it, right? So we don't think that kind of perfection is possible. But the second thing is, we don't even think, at least I don't even think it's desirable. I don't want to be a person who doesn't have desires or doesn't have attachments. My attachments are important to me. My attachment to my wife and my attachment to my sister and to my children, these are tremendously meaningful. What would a life be like for me if I didn't have them? And not only that, but there are things that, it's a very ascetic kind of religion. If you look at the rule and code for monks, for example, they're not allowed to swim or climb trees or play musical instruments or wear perfume or tickle each other. Then they're not allowed to do anything that's just fun, you know. I'd like the idea of going to the opera, and I like the idea of singing and dancing, and I like the idea of having a drink once in a while, and I like having sexual relations with my wife and so forth. Do I want all that to disappear? And what would it be like if we didn't desire things, you know, if we didn't care about things in that way? The Chinese philosopher Mencius tells a story about a passerby who sees a child fall into a well, and he feels alarm and distress. And of course, he's going to run and rescue that child. And Mencius says, this is hardwired into us as beings that we care about other people, and we're distressed when something bad happens to them. Do we want to get rid of that? What would that be like to see the baby fall in the well and go, oh, you know, how would we even survive as a species if we became that calm and that serene and that not caring about things in that kind of way? So I think the direction is a wrong way for Western Buddhists, at least. And I think what we've done in the Buddhist community in the West is we've really taken some notions of well-being that are really derived from the Greek tradition, from Aristotle, about what it means to be a admirable and virtuous person, and a person who's rational and thoughtful and friendly and all the other virtues that Aristotle lists. We really take that as what we want to be. We want to become all we are capable of being, as the Army commercial says, right? My college motto at the University, State University of New York in Binghamton was, be all that you, let each become all they are capable of being. We have this Aristotelian notion of development. And I think what we've done in the West is we've melded that with the Buddhist idea, so that the idea no longer is get rid of all attachments, but develop wise attachments. It isn't get rid of all desires, but be able to discern which desires are really in your long-term best interest and those of others, and which ones really undermine you in some kind of way. The philosopher John Dewey used to talk about this as the difference between valuing and evaluation, that we value sweet things because they make us feel good. But when we evaluate it, if we're diabetics, we realize, well, maybe it really isn't for our good. And that's what I think Western Buddhism tries to do. It has to look at thoughts, feelings, urges that come up and ask, are these really constructive or not? Are they going to lead to our long-term well-being? Are they consonant with our higher order values? Okay, and let's put our life in order. And mindfulness gives us a chance to do that. So I think that's been the trend in Western Buddhism, is to be more of a eudaimonic kind of Buddhism, more looking at it as a tool for well-being and personal growth, rather than achieving the kind of state that was talked about in traditional Buddhism of reaching nirvana and reaching some enlightenment, as if there is some place you could arrive, which is the final arriving place, where you know everything and see everything. We know that's not true.
That was very well said. And I have noticed some tension and some some of my readings, there seems to be a debate or argument around should some of these principles be taken out of their original context because there was an ethical piece to them that was let go of, perhaps. And I don't know if that is the correct argument or a perfect argument. How have you taken such an argument where the piecemeal approach of taking out some practices and applying them to a Western mind that could appreciate, as you said, those definitions with current time and context, but letting go of some of the things, maybe not so culturally fit, like some of the things you said about nirvana and these certain heightened states of consciousness, maybe not those, but just how we should act, like friendly kindness and do no harm principles that are part of our culture. Also, do we already have those? So it's okay. And then we can pull this into the Western culture more and let go of some of those things, even though they may be similar, we just have different language to describe them. Or is there a true problem? I always wonder about this question.
Okay. Well, let me, there are so many questions in there. Let me separate some of them out. Okay. So let me start with mindfulness itself. And the recent article I published in the Humanistic Psychologist on mindfulness in and out of the context of Western Buddhist modernism. The question dealt there with is, can mindfulness be a standalone technique that's good in and of itself, in the way that doing push-ups or brushing your teeth can be good in and of itself, a skill that you learned and it makes you healthier in some kind of way? Or is it not at all a technique, but something that is something can only be have benefits if it's introduced within the context of a particular kind of philosophy? In other words, you're not learning a skill so much as you're developing a whole different relationship to your thoughts and feelings and to other people and to life in general. So that it's this philosophy that you're picking up from the practice that's important, rather than just training your attention to stay at a certain point over and over again. So the context that mindfulness exists in traditional Buddhism is that it's one of the eight step rungs of the Eightfold Noble Path, right? So it's in conjunction with a whole variety of other factors, which includes concentration, but also includes sila, which is the Pali word for morality. So for example, the five precepts of not killing and not stealing and not lying and so forth, those are integrated in with mindfulness. So you don't just talk about mindfulness, which is the word is sati, but you talk about samasati, right mindfulness. Okay, there could be wrong mindfulness too. Okay, within Western Buddhism, and within the, I want to be clear that when John Kabat-Zinn lifts mindfulness and creates MBSR, he isn't just using Theravada Buddhism, the Southeast Asian Buddhism of the Insight Meditation Society. He was trained in Korean Zen before he ever did that, so he has a Zen perspective on things. But he's also been aware of all kinds of trends within Western psychology and humanistic psychology, for example, and everything coming out of Esalen and Big Sur and all the kinds of new trends within humanistic and transpersonal psychology that evolved over those years. He's also aware of non-Buddhist teachings on present moment centeredness. I'm thinking about people like Krishnamurti or Gurdjieff, for example, who are teaching these things. He's also aware of Gestalt therapy, which is very much present moment centered and being aware of your current emotions and behaviors and so forth. So I think all of this was part of the mix when he developed MBSR. He wasn't trying to replicate Buddhism pure and simple. I think he was creating something that was really a new thing, of which Buddhism was one of the many influences in it. All right. Now, a lot of critics have suggested that once you begin teaching mindfulness as a standalone technique, just a way to build your attentional muscles, so to speak, or change, rewire your brain in relationship between the prefrontal cortex, for example, and the cingulate cortex and what have you, you're taking it out of any kind of ethical context, then does it really have any kind of real value for people at that point? And if you look at the way John teaches it, or way MBCRs teach, there is an ethical component to it. First of all, the teachers are modeling a kind of implicit ethics all along in the way they carefully listen to people, in the way they're supportive of people, their own openness to experience, their own honesty and integrity in the practice. They're all modeling that all the way through. And then they're teaching things like loving kindness meditation, you know, somewhere in there, okay? So compassion and loving kindness are being modeled within that system. And then they integrate some of Neff's work on self-compassion as well. I mean, a lot of that gets integrated in nowadays. So I think there is an ethical framework that is normally attached to it in the way it's ordinarily taught. And sometimes it's implicit rather than explicit. Sometimes a little bit of it is explicit. You have to worry about programs that develop that don't have any of those connections at all. Okay. Do they exist? I haven't personally run into them, but I'm sure they exist, you know. And so questions arise as the kinds of questions that have arisen, for example, about teaching mindfulness within the military to prevent attentional degradation, or teaching mindfulness within corporate settings and so forth. And there's a concern that mindfulness can be co-opted so that it's no longer situated within an environment of, for example, if you're just teaching people to relax and be calm and accept the current situation they're in, okay, and you're not asking them to stand up for their values, to recognize what their values are and to have courage and stand up for them as part of what's going on, then are you just teaching them how to adapt to a system that maybe is kind of rotten to begin with and not encouraging them to make any changes in it? Or in military training, are you just teaching people how to be more mindful snipers, for example? It sounds far-fetched, but there are historical historical examples of this. So, for example, D.T. Suzuki wrote about the way that samurai use Zen, for example, to be efficient killers. Okay. D.T. Suzuki may have been exaggerating a bit. There may not have been that many samurais who actually did that. But the Japanese Zen masters sold that to the Japanese war effort, that Zen could be a religion that could help people kill better. Their kamikaze pilots and so forth could die for their country without any regrets because they're just focused on the mission, you know, and they didn't get distracted by other kinds of things. And in my article, I also point out a number of examples of notorious killers who also use meditation to assist in this. So, for example, I tell the story of, I forget his name, I think in Norway, that horrible person who killed all those people on that island, all those children, over 70 of them. He meditated regularly. And I tell the story about a rapist in New York who would sit by a stream in Central Park and meditate before stalking his victims. And these people found that this kind of calmed them and focused them. And it was the way that a cat can calm and focus itself, you know, when it's focused on predation. So I don't want to think that meditation is a neutral kind of instrument. It can be used for good or evil in some ways. And if it's not in the context of benevolence and a humanistic philosophy, it can be used for anti-humanistic purposes. So again, I think the context that it's taught in is very important, and there needs to be some kind of ethical component. And that ethical component doesn't have to be explicit. We're not telling people how to vote or what they think the best economic policy for the United States ought to be or how their businesses ought to change. But we're telling them that they ought to have a full awareness that includes moral considerations, you know, within it.
Those are outstanding and impactful points you have me thinking in a little concerned way with your two or more examples there about how this can be used. You did bring up like the workplace for maybe increasing performance. I know sports teams are doing this to some degree to stabilize athletes and perhaps increase performance, and many other practices of visualization and other things may have been similar in the past. But I like your point. It's not necessarily that these could be negative things. I guess the intention becomes important. Do you have some words for people on the practice of mindfulness and why intentions then are so perhaps value-laden and important versus just focusing a skill like attention or being able to regulate emotion and then go out and do something negative to another person. So what are your thoughts on setting good intentions or intentions that are useful?
Society? I'm not opposed to Amisha Jha's program in the military or programs in corporations per se. I think they can be well done. And personally, if I think we have to have soldiers, I think they're going to be around for some time to come. And I'd like to have them trained so that when they fire their weapon, they do so with a sense of wisdom and calmness and not out of a sense of panic or hysteria or, you know, paranoia. So I think teaching anyone how to kind of take a breath, take a full awareness of the whole situation you're in, you know, take a moment before you react. I think that's good training for anybody. So, so I don't want to minimize the importance of doing it, but I think that when you're going into the military or when you're going into a corporation with a program, you just have to be very thoughtful about how you sell the program. You know, are you going to the employer and saying this will reduce absenteeism and reduce healthcare utilization, and you know, or are you also saying this will make people more aware of their values as well, and it may make employees more aware of when their values and those of the corporation are not in alignment, and that when they feel like they have to take action about that. I think you don't want to neuter these programs so that they're only half programs. I think if you want people to grow, they have to grow morally as well as attentionally and as well as developing some internal sense of security and serenity and so forth. So you just have to be very thoughtful. I mean, there are so many, you want to make the sale. You're developing a program and you're going up to a corporation, you're going up to Amazon or, you know, Google or whatever company you're going to, and you want to make the sale of this program. But at the same time, you don't want to sell it in a way that really really makes the program less than it ought to be in some kind of way. When I took the internship with Jon Kabat-Zinn's program, one of the things they taught us was a four-step process, which I remember this and I've used it in my teaching all the time, which is number one, show up. Step number one is show up. Step number two is pay attention. Step number three is discover what's your truth in this moment through that, in that quiet space. And then the fourth is take action commensurate with your understanding. Okay. And don't be overly attached to that action, because maybe it's a mistake, right? You don't know for sure until you see the feedback that you get. But you take that action without too much attachment and you hope for the best. And then you watch again and show up again and pay attention again and then act again to tell your truth and do what's necessary in that moment. So alignment in accord with your values was always part of that training. We talk about mindfulness is supposed to be non-judgmental, but that doesn't mean we get rid of our values and don't have them anymore. It just means we create a space where we recognize that whatever is, okay? And that we have to deal with the reality of how it is. But it doesn't mean that we don't care about the outcome or we don't desire some outcomes more than other ones. The other story I love to tell is one that Larry Rosenberg told me. He was a teacher at the Cambridge Insight Meditation Society. And he said that if a meditator was sitting in a meditation hall and the hall was on fire, he wouldn't be the person sitting there going warm, warmer, hot, hotter. He'd be the first person opening the door and getting one out. I mean, there's a sense in which values are really, it's not just being aware of things, but it really is that whole panoply of values that you mentioned. Okay, now on to that question. These values, the values of the West, the values of the East, and so forth. I'm writing a book right now that's comparing Greek ethics, ancient Greek ethics, with Buddhist ethics, with ancient Confucian ethics. And what I'm seeing is there's a common thread that runs through all of them. Okay, they really are tremendously similar. These are, ethicists kind of look at ethics and they divide it into a number of different approaches to ethics. There's Kant's approach, which is called deontology, and there's, say, John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham's method, which is called utilitarianism. And the Aristotelian method is called virtue ethics. It means that there aren't rules for how to be a good person. But what you do is you try to identify people that you know from your own life or from history that seem to be exemplary people, and you ask, what would they do in this situation and then try to act like they would. And through practice, you try to develop virtues like honesty or courage, integrity, benevolence, and so forth. Okay. So Aristotle and Confucius and the Buddha are all pretty much in agreement about what these main virtues are. And they all begin with something very much like the golden rule, right? Confucius calls, says, a single thread runs through all my teachings, and that's reciprocity. Don't do to others what you would not have them do unto you. And Hillel says the same thing in the Talmud, you know, about what the Torah is. Is the entire Torah is just don't do unto others what you don't want to do unto you, you know, and everything else is just commentary. So there is a sense in which cooperation with other people, finding ways to compassionately and friendly relate to other people, to care about other people in general, is the fundamental of Confucian virtue. It's also the fundament of Buddhist virtue, compassion and loving kindness. And friendliness is also there, you know, as one of the main virtues within Aristotle as well. So you can probably identify about five or six virtues, some kind of benevolence, goodwill towards other people, some sense of fairness and justice, some sense of self-restraint, okay, not just doing everything on the moment, but actually being mindful and wise about what you do. I mean, there are a number of virtues that carry through all of these and are the common themes. And I think we just have to take those. They're in our Western culture every much as they are in Buddhist culture and Confucian culture. There are differences of emphasis and so forth, but I think we can weld something, a kind of a universal ethics that we can attach to mindfulness that I think would be acceptable to almost everybody.
It seems like some of these concepts, generosity, competency in some specific helpful way, respect and other things would help people in modern society too. I don't know the data on these things, but perhaps based on personality structure that supports those things and cultivation of those skills themselves would help people do better in a social world like today. So is there something inherent in the practice itself that would help people do well in a highly social environment like ours?
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, I think the biggest problem we have in our culture today is the effect of polarization between political factions right now, so that one third of Democrats and one third of Republicans would be horrified if their child were to marry a member of the other party. I mean, they would rather that they married a different religion or a different ethnic group than a different political group. So, and effective polarization, the mark of it is really disdain and contempt for the other side, okay? Assuming that the other side is malevolent and ignorant and I'm trying to think of what other words might go along with that. And both sides feel that way about the other. So any practice that could help people drop those assumptions that we understand the motivations of other people and to just be with other people and really listen to them in some kind of way, even if we disagree with them, give them a space where they can express their view. I think that's helpful in healing the divide and letting us know that we all don't have to believe the same thing. I mean, that kind of general acceptance of diversity includes diversity of political opinion as well. We don't all have to agree. Let's just find some places we can agree on and work forward on. You know, that's what this whole infrastructure bill coming through right now is. Maybe we disagree on 1,000 things, but maybe we can agree on some things. So finding a culture that's civil again, I think is absolutely crucial. And really a general emphasis on benevolence and compassion and loving kindness is a great place to start.
Yeah, these,
you know, I may disagree with you on 1,000 things, and we may be opponents in 1,000 different arenas, but on the other hand, I respect you as a human being and care about your own well-being and happiness.
Yeah, the value system appears to promote civility. No,
right, and that's core. Part of what we do, right? When we do loving kindness meditation, we take the person we consider most difficult in our lives, and we wish them well, and imagine that, and want them to be happy and healthy and free from fear and loved.
And sometimes we begin with ourselves and
well, that's where we
unveiling
that's where we
of
start.
Our own evils, right? And we see our evils in ourselves and those that others signal to us, and we can find part of that in ourselves. And there's the common humanity, right?
Yeah, I used to run a meditation group for psychotic and severely depressed patients in the psychiatric hospital, inpatients. And it was voluntary. They didn't have to come, but anyone who wanted to come, we would do a 45-minute meditation, which a lot of people say you should never do with these patients, right? But they loved coming. And sometimes we did the loving kindness meditation, and usually they found that first part, extending compassion towards themselves, the most important part of it. It was the hardest thing for them to do, and yet the most impactful thing for them to do.
So in the article that you mentioned in a recent special issue, there's this term that stood out. It seemed central, which was eudaimonic enlightenment. And you have 10 core definitions, and we don't need to go into them all. Maybe this was an important element that unifies some of the things we're talking about.
Yes.
Do you want to define that concept and maybe just talk about a few and why it's related to mindfulness practices?
Sure. Well, in looking at how do modern Western Buddhists who are modernists and not traditionalists look at enlightenment, what do they really talk about when they talk about enlightenment in their Dharma talks? You know, because I've heard thousands of talks over the years from different traditions, insight meditations, Zen, Tibetan traditions, and so forth. And you listen to what they really tend to talk about as opposed to what the texts say. Okay, and they talk about a few things, and they're all pretty much in agreement on that. And this is what I'm calling eudaimonic enlightenment. It's a kind of moving to a more positive. It's moving to a state of well-being that's above what normal well-being is. It's not perfect well-being, but it's better than the average bear, so to speak. And I think there are a number of things they talk about. One is becoming aware of your thoughts and emotions, and being able to recognize when those thoughts and emotions and desires and urges are helpful and when they're not. In other words, you're able to recognize them and say, if I can continue to go in this direction, will I end up being happier or will I end up being miserable? Okay. So let's suppose you're an alcoholic and the urge is to drink, and you can ask yourself, you know, if I go ahead and give into the drink, will in the end that increase my long-term happiness, will detract from it? And once you decide it's not in your long-term interest to do it, then you do urge surfing, right? You let the urge increase and watch, and just tolerate it, and eventually it recedes, right? And you just watch that happen too. So it's that ability to observe and watch desires, thoughts, feelings as they come up, and not get gripped by them and captured by them and taken over by them, but be able to stand back from them a little bit and see them from a distance with some sense of perspective and equanimity. And if you watch a thought, for example, the thought, I'm a complete jerk, comes up. Okay. If you allow that thought to go by your radar and allow it to just occur without challenging it in any way or doing anything with it, you can feel rotten for the rest of the day. But if you just watch it happen and say, oh, look, there's that thought, I'm a jerk, with quotation marks around it, okay, because you have a little bit of distance from it, then it doesn't have that devastating effect on you. It's just a thought. So being able to detach somewhat, to be able to observe your own thoughts, feelings, and motivations, be able to have some degree of detachment from them, be able to discern when they're wise and when they're not wise, and being able to drop or let go of or just observe without acting on them is crucially important. And being recognized that everything you think doesn't have truth value to it, that just because you thought it doesn't mean it's true. I remember seeing a bumper sticker on a car once that said, don't believe everything you think. Well, that's part of what's going on here. It's recognizing that our thoughts are just thoughts. They're not truths. So I think those two are terribly important. And then as you begin to do that better, as you begin to observe your thoughts and be less reactive to them, and as you be able to develop constructive responses to urges rather than just being captured by them, I think that develops a sense of equanimity within. You're not driven hither and thither by everything that comes up. You have this real sense of internal stability. So I think that's part of what's happening too when you think about eudaimonic well-being. And there's also an understanding of greater acceptance of life as it is. Not that we have to like everything that happens, okay? But that you don't. There's the expression that we sometimes use in teaching mindfulness that suffering is pain times resistance, okay? That it's not the pain so much that causes the suffering, but it's the resistance against it that causes the suffering. I'll tell you a story of a patient I had many years ago. who came to me, and he says, the doctors tell me, he says, I have the back of a 100-year-old man. My x-ray showed that. He says, I'm in such pain all the time, right? And he says, he's not working. He's on disability. His wife is about to divorce him because he can't engage in sex anymore. It's too painful. His back hurts all the time. And anyway, so guy used to be a boxer. So we use that metaphor about you used to be a fighter. What happened to you? You know, how can you be a fighter again? And we also, it wasn't just psychotherapy. We also put him on an antidepressant medication, right? 3 months later, he's working two jobs. His wife is very happy with their sexual life. And he's ready for discharge from my treatment, right? He's fine. And then I asked a stupid question. I say to him, say, Jack, how's your pain now? Thinking somehow that the pain was caused by his depression and now that he's not depressed, the pain is gone. He says, oh, it's just as bad as it always was. I'm saying, oh, really? Well, how come you're doing all these things now? And he says, well, the pain used to be at the center of my life. He says, now it's off to the side somewhere. Okay. So the pain hasn't gone away, but there's a different relationship to it. And I think that's what we're cultivating. There's a different relation to all the pains in life. Okay. I mean, I look at my own life and there's been plenty of cause for pain. You know, I've had a number of forms of cancer. I've had some serious surgery in that regard. I have diabetes. My first wife died of bladder cancer, you know. My second wife has just suffered a stroke and a congestive heart failure. There's more than enough sorrow to go around in life, okay? But that doesn't mean that we have to be sorrowful, because there's also more than enough joy to go around in life. And if we accept these things, have these happened? Yes. Has my life changed? Yes. Do I have to I'm a diabetic. Do I have to eat differently now? Yes. Okay. But none of that means I have to suffer. It just means I have to take care of myself. Okay. And life can still be grand despite all that. And I think that's what we're trying to cultivate in this kind of well-being, the sense of, yes, bad things happen. And yes, sometimes there are things we can do about them. Sometimes there aren't. Sometimes we just have to suck it up. But that doesn't mean we say, why me? You know, and oh, I can never be happy again unless all these things are fixed. I mean, that's what gets into trouble, are those crazy ideas. And when we see them, when we're being mindful, we can just say, hi, there you are again, and let them go and go back into living our lives.
Yeah, these trials and tribulations of life, it seems we will learn many of these lessons one way or the other, if we can make it over time, right?
That's right.
So it seems like for me, meditation practice has been about quickening one's maturity into this life and accepting roles and responsibilities in this life. So you had me thinking along those lines that this maturity will be found likely. I mean, you know, if you can manage a normal, healthy mental space, but can you do that more quickly for the benefit of you and those around you? Seems pretty important. Can you mature more quickly in a world that can offer you a lot of things to support your immaturity, right?
That's right.
Quick reward, all of these things that don't teach us those longer term lessons of patience, empathy, and these other things that usually take some tragedy in life to help you see more clearly.
Yeah. And you can also ask, as you do these, a lot of people start meditation for selfish reasons. They want to be happier in very self-centered ways. And I think another thing the practice does is it opens us up to the fact that real joy, the deepest joy, comes from being of real value and service to other people. You know, for me, no greater pleasure. There's no greater pleasure in life than knowing that you've really made some difference, that you're the fact that you're here has made someone else's life better in some kind of way. You know?
Yeah. Well said. That's the truth. So you're an active scholar, Seth. What's next on your plate? You were mentioning a new book, maybe broad concept. What's in mind for you? What's motivating and exciting you right now as a scholar?
I have three projects. One is the most important one for me is this ethics, both book on ethics and the commonalities between different forms of virtue ethics and what lessons that might have for us during our current crisis of democracy. A second project is I've been working on a chapter on Buddhism and positive psychology. Jean Cristiello and I have been doing this chapter together, and it's looking at both areas of tension and areas of complementarity between traditional Buddhist teachings and psychology, of which mindfulness is just one. I mean, there are whole other applications of Buddhism within psychology as well, besides mindfulness. I've just finished a chapter on philosophical considerations in meditation. So it's looking at meditation from point of view of different philosophies, and what do meditative states really tell us about the nature of ourselves and the nature of reality, and how can they be, and how do they help in terms of eudaimonic development, you know, eudaimonic enlightenment. And then I've just been invited to also co-write a chapter on ethics and East Asian Buddhism with a fellow who's a Chinese scholar. So I'm looking forward to writing that as well. So all kinds of interesting new areas.
Great. And where can people find you?
Where can online? They find me?
I'll find you online.
I have a personal author website, www.sethzuihosegall. That's sethzuihosegall.com. And my podcasts are on there. There are a number of articles that you can link to there, including some of my recent articles for Tricycle, the Buddhist Review, that covers a lot of the things we're talking about right now.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Seth, for our conversation today. It was really important for me to see the historical context of MBSR, its merging at convergence and divergence from the various stemmings of conventional Buddhism, and what we are likely to gain and perhaps potentials of things to be lost. So it was a great conversation. Our listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org, goamra.org, and you can support us by becoming a member or subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.